Okay, and welcome everyone to the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution and Civic Responsibility. It is a Wednesday. It is the 29th day of January. It remains cold, but there is light at the end of the tunnel. So at least that's what all the weather folks are saying, as there's going to be a significant warm-up after tonight. We're going to get really cold tonight. Now, this is just here in the east, but I think it's affecting such a large portion of the nation that I think it probably affects a lot of folks that are listening. It is 3 p.m. on this Wednesday in the east. We're starting an hour early today, and I neglected to alert listeners yesterday that we would be starting an hour early today. My choice was then is to either start an hour early, recognizing that some people probably won't be joining us until our second hour, figuring that that's when we begin, or I could begin at the start at the regular time and just cut the program short by an hour. And we kind of decided that we'd go this route, and because so many people pick up the program on iPod and those kinds of things anyway, that listen to it later, in other words, that we would try to get the 2 hours in. And there's really a difference, because I wanted to deal with the standards today. And if we were just going to do 1 hour, I was just going to launch directly into the standards, because I don't want this week to end and let another 4-day period go by before we get back together again next Monday without at least addressing the standards a little bit and getting into this, since we're kind of on a 3-day roll here, and I want to try to wrap it up if I can today. But the fact that we're going to be doing 2 hours, I think we'll have time to do that and a few other things besides. Again, I thank you for tuning in. I invite you to participate actively. I've been telling a number of folks today about the call we received today from Mike, and just a fantastic call. And and the day before we had a call from Dr. John on the road in Pennsylvania. I mean, this, if you think about this is just amazing. I guess maybe I'm still I still look at all this technology stuff as magic. And I'm like a kid. I just can't believe some of these things. You know, to be reading an email that was sent from Sweden, and I mean, it's just wonderful. What an opportunity! What a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to learn and think and talk together and to share ideas and hopefully provide some information which would allow all of us to learn a little bit from all of it. Love to hear from you. Our phone number is area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. My personal email address, if you'd like to communicate with me directly, is waobrien906@gmail.com. That's waobrien906@gmail.com. What I'd like to do today, as a prelude to the standards, is first of all draw a few conclusions from the material, from the criticisms of the standards that we were looking at yesterday, and then look at a couple of documents. And I'm saying this because I'm teaching a class, and we happen to be working with these particular documents anyway. They're kind of right here. I have them right here in handy. And I thought I would basically use them as illustrations of the kinds of things that I hope the standards will be able to promote on a wider scale. So basically, what I would like to do today is to complete the criticism of the standards and then suggest or take on the question as to whether the standards can effectively work at all. In other words, whether in fact we can improve the quality of our education system for significantly more youngsters, students, than we've been able to do in the past. And then look at the standards and try to speculate a little bit as to whether in fact these standards, if followed and if adopted and enforced, would truly begin a turnaround in our education system. I believe, and again, I have to say at the very front, this is extremely optimistic, extremely idealistic. I understand that. But I think we're in much better optimistic than pessimistic. But on the other hand, I have to acknowledge that there's an awful lot to be optimistic about. I guess I was a little bit disappointed in the State of the Union message last night, only because I didn't think the President's message was quite optimistic and positive enough. I was really hoping for a little bit more cheerleading about economic recovery and about the creation of jobs and about improvement in our education system and all the rest of it. I got a little bit of that about with increasing the minimum wage and starting retirement programs for the working poor in a program that he calls MyRA. But it wasn't as much as I'd hoped. I kind of think this was the fifth State of the Union message that this president has delivered, the first one of his second term, and I thought that the second one of his second term, and for by this time next year, everybody's going to be looking at the 2016 elections, and the fall elections. This year will have been over. So, for all practical purposes, I think the president's going to be moving into the lame duck status of his second administration a year from now. The reason I say that is because I kind of thought that this was really, in some ways, his last opportunity to really take on his opponents and really begin to push. And he pushed, but not quite as hard as I'd hoped. But anyway, be that as it may, let's begin. If you remember, we were looking at first we looked at conservatives who criticize the Common Core, and of course their major focus. We looked at George Will, and their major focus is on obviously on the fact that it seems to amount to a federal takeover of education when the tradition of this nation has been that education is a locally controlled thing, controlled by community and parents and teachers and local businesses and these kinds of things. And because of the accountability factor built into standards and built into the standardized testing that goes along with it, accountability is going to be to those who evaluate the test results rather than to the parents and the communities that traditionally have controlled education in this society. And the line that I quoted yesterday during Mike's call, and I wanted to repeat it again because I think it's very, very significant. It's only one line. The question that the critics, conservative critics, raise about the standards, once you accept the fact that parents and local communities and local businesses are pretty much losing control of what happens in the schools in their own districts, as accountability is increasingly wielded out of Washington with the results of, in the analysis of the results of these standardized tests, the question that is raised: to whom can parents complain when their children come home with a book that threatens the values of their community, of their family, excuse me, of their community would work just as well. In other words, if parents don't like what their kids are being asked to read, who do they complain to? Obviously, that question is pretty much in line with conservative concerns about the flow of power and decision-making, the centralizing of education in the hands of Washington bureaucrats. But I would suggest something else that's not considered, and that is that except for the very young children, youngsters who come home with books that seem to advocate values that aren't consistent with those in the family. If the child is really being educated, the child will be able to recognize the dichotomy in values. And that becomes part of the education. In other words, the answer to this question about to whom can parents complain, if true education was really happening, students themselves could handle these kinds of concerns. But that seems to not be in anybody's frame of reference. Nobody seems to think about that. Instead, what they're focusing on, whether decisions are being made in Washington or decisions are being made in state capitals or decisions are being made at county courthouses or whatever. In other words, the major concern that these people who are most concerned about the standards have is a concern about who makes the decisions. The one thing that is never considered is to begin educating youngsters in a way which allows them to become masters of their own fate. They can recognize dichotomies in values. They can recognize the inconsistencies between the values that they've been adjusted to or acquainted with in their local communities versus the kind of values that they're getting in literature. I go back to the story we saw some weeks ago in 1816 about the Senate's passage of tax legislation which imposed a high import tax on foreign books in order to discourage foreign books from coming into the United States, thereby protecting our young people from alien, strange, or dangerous values. I would suggest to you that education itself can be the best protection against dangerous and alien values. But we in this society have never been willing to risk that. Our approach has always been to make sure that we control what kids learn and memorize so that we determine the values that these kids will come out of school with. I would suggest to you that the value system that goes along with that approach to education doesn't run very deep. And consequently, we end up with a lot of young people that are very confused and very conflicted and finally decide that it's not worth worrying about anyway. Instead of weighing alternative value systems and focusing on a value system that seems to work for each individual, instead we have turned our education system into a power struggle between ideologues on different sides of the political aisle, each of them competing for the right to control the minds of our children. The missing element is the decision that they all ought to be able to reach, that the best thing we can do is educate our youngsters in such a way that their minds develop in such ways that they can handle these controversies for themselves. And I think that's very consistent. In order to bring this particular facet of the story to a conclusion, I think that it's very significant that the final conclusion on the standards
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
America to redress, such as entrenched racial inequality and the exploitation of poverty wage workers. But now I've learned that joining the gritty struggle for justice is not the proper way to honor King. No, no, 'tis a far better thing you do if you just traipse down to a local McDonald's outlet, order a Happy Meal, and join the joyous integrated Golden Arches family in singing a few verses of Kumbaya. At least, that's what the world's largest hamburger chain urged us to do in a shameless PR campaign. It used this year's MLK Day to try whitewashing its own sorry record of worker mistreatment. One full-page ad pictured three McDonald's crew members, each one a person of color, beaming with delight above ad copy that extolled the corporation's commitment to, quote, a diverse and inclusive workforce. I think Dr. King would have upchucked and asked, what about a workforce that's paid a living wage, with benefits, so they don't have to work second or third jobs and go on food stamps to subsidize the labor costs of this miserly, super-rich fast-food empire? The touchy-feely ad turned a total squish at the end, calling on all Americans to embrace their differences. We can't imagine a better way to honor King's Day than by doing just that. This is Jim Hightower saying, Dr. King, however, had a sharper imagination than that. He would have helped the workers unionize McDonald's to gain real justice for themselves.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
So the Insaniacs are still at it because over the Super Bowl ad put out by Coke. How dare they? How dare they have them non-American people singing America the Beautiful? It's America, darn it! I've gotten so many interesting comments on the it's an English only. It's an English only song. I'm going, really? Is that how it is? But the funniest one I've come across is that this is a stealth campaign to push for amnesty for immigration. And you know, as this guy, Pat Dollard, he is a former Hollywood agent of some sort. He says he's exposed the ad, you know, as a stealth appeal for immigration amnesty, and it could be something worse, something even more sinister, like the Muslims are coming. Because, of course, he points out that the CEO, Muhtar Kent, is a Muslim who was raised in places like Iran and Indonesia, and maybe he's got some other ideas. Yeah. You know, when I watched it, I'm interested what other people thought when they watched the big commercial. Coke's got to be thrilled that they've gotten this much play out of it. If that was the intention. Personally, I think it was just, this is a company that has been all-inclusive for a while, because understand, they're global. And they don't care about individual countries. Forget the idea that that's an American company. That is a global company who want to appeal to a vast number of people. So from a corporate standpoint, they don't care about crazy white men buying their product as much as they do the billions of people around the world who, if they look a little inclusive and tick off a couple of white and stale male guys, they're okay with that, I think. And, you know, what it is what's interesting to me is it's that xenophobe who sticks his head in the sand and says, we just don't want those immigrants here, and would vote for Republicans because they're anti-immigrant, because they're anti-other. And I've always said that the white male working class guy, people like me, when I look in the mirror, I could be one of those folks. But I guess I've just read a little too much, and I understand what the Republican Party really is about. And it's not about the divisive stuff. It's not about immigration. It's not about gay marriage. It's not about abortion. It's about none of that. That's the stuff that they shine in our face. Go, oh, over here, see? Don't look over there. Look here. There's the shiny thing. It's like a cat with a laser light or a catnip toy. Same thing. That's what they do to their constituents. That's what they do to Republican voters. When the reality is, and Ray sent me this article that was written a couple of days ago by Pat Buchanan. Now, I've never been a huge fan of Pat Buchanan. On economic issues, I think on some level he's sane. Most other things, not so much. But at least on economic, especially on trade issues, I agree with him. When he ran for president back in, I think it was 92, you know, there were some things that I agreed with, especially economics. 96, definitely, with the trade policies and all that. Absolutely. Now, the insane stuff, the crazy xenophobe stuff, not so much. In fact, not at all. But, you know, on economics, we agree. So he wrote this piece. And I think you can get it over at Town Hall, one of those right-wing sites. It's titled "How the GOP Lost Middle America," and he's talking about. He starts off by saying, "Well, you know, the House is going to capitulate. They're giving up. They've given in on you know, going after the illegal immigrants, and you know they're going to give them amnesty. They're not going to deport them. But their only hang up is that we don't want to make them citizens." And I'm of the mindset, look, if you're going to let them stay here and you're going to let them work here, and you should probably move them towards being citizens. Why not? you know, makes sense. But he points out, and look, this is an anti-immigrant piece, is what it is. But in the heart of it is really some very, and I look, every Republican, you need to examine your party affiliation. And this article is a good place to start. So he goes into this how the Republicans lost the party. And he said, to understand why and how the Republican Party lost Middle America and faces demographic death, he says, we need to go back to Bush 1. He said, at the Cold War's end, the GOP reached a fork in the road. The determination of Middle Americans to preserve the country they grew up in suddenly collided with the profit motive of corporate America. He said the Fortune 500 wanted to close factories in the U.S. and ship production abroad, where unions did not exist, regulations were light, taxes were low, and wages were a fraction of what they were here in America. Corporate America was going global, Pat Buchanan writes, and wanted to rid itself, rid its American workforce, the best paid on earth, and replace it with cheap foreign labor. He points out while manufacturing sought to move production abroad, you had hotels and motels and bars and restaurants and farms and construction companies that couldn't move abroad, but they also wanted to replace their expensive American labor. And thanks to the Republican Party, Pat Buchanan, lifelong Republican, writes, corporate America got it all. He says U.S. factories in the scores of thousands were shut down, shedding American workers, foreign-made goods poured in, filling America's stores, and killing the manufacturers who had stayed behind, loyal to their U.S. workers. One of the things I don't agree with what he points out is the next thing he says is, the Reagan prosperity was exported to Asia and China by Bush Republicans, and the Reagan Democrats reciprocated by deserting the Bush Republican Party and going home. I completely disagree with that. Understand, NAFTA was dreamt up during the Reagan years. At the end of the Reagan years, the whole neoliberal agenda of trade that we've been following started during the Nixon years and moved forward all the way through all of the deregulation, all of the lower taxes, all of the, oh, we need less regulation, lower taxes, and free trade. This is coming back from the 70s. None of this stuff just happened overnight. It didn't just land in H.W. Bush's lap. This was years. This was almost a generation of the wealth class of this country saying, we want to screw those workers, and we're going to lay the groundwork doing it. And they used Reagan as the tool to do it. So don't give me that, well, the Reagan prosperity. Nonsense. It was his high-dollar policy. It was his trade policy that began this stuff. But here again, I give the Buchanan some credit. He goes on later in the article to say what was wildly wonderful for corporate America was hell on middle America. He says, but the Republican Party had made its choice. It had sold its soul to the multinationals. And as it went along with NAFTA, GATT, Fast Track, and mass immigration to appease corporate America, it lost middle America. The party went with the folks who paid for their campaigns, only to lose the folks who had given them the landslides. He points out that the people who are coming to the country, and he gets into this whole, you know, they're Asians and Africans and they're Middle Eastern and they're Latin Americans, and these are people, he says, third world country people. They believe in government action. They believe in government programs that provide their families with free education, health care, housing, food, and income subsidies. These aren't the Bob Taft or Barry Goldwater conservatives. Now, understand, they weren't presidents either. And I would argue that my grandparents' generation fought for a social safety net, fought for education for their children, fought for health care for people. And to then, you know, and this is where Buchanan and I'll split with him. To say that, well, it's these immigrants who want these things. No, it's Americans who want these things. It's working people who want these things. But listen, my Republican friends, he's right. He is absolutely right on what corporate America did to this country. And basically, you know, he wrote what I've been saying on this program for 8 years. This is what happened. Your party did this. And now there are those, the corporate party, who want to go after workers' rights to organize. Why? So corporations can have more power. That's all it's about. Plain and simple. Doesn't get any easier than that. More for them, less for you. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Albert Klein. Many conservatives lashed out at Coca-Cola for their Super Bowl advertisement featuring a multilingual rendition of America the Beautiful. On The Five, Fox host Eric Bolling complained.
For whatever you gain in this diversity thing that you're going for, Coke, you blew it with a lot of people who are very, very patriotic about that song. About that song.
But anchorwoman Brenda Wood of WXIA in Atlanta demolished these myths in her segment, Brenda's Last Word.
But the fact that people are outraged over this ad is outrageous itself. People indignant that others would have the audacity to sing America the Beautiful in a language other than English when America was built on opening its arms to the world. The quote on the Statue of Liberty doesn't say, give me your English-speaking only Christian-believing heterosexual masses. It says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, tempest-tossed.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425. Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Got an email from during the break from John who says, you know, Pat Buchanan, absolutely right on this, but nothing else. Not a big Pat Buchanan fan, went into some interesting statements, kind of reminding, you know, of the past, you know, Buchanan, he points out that during his speeches, it was better read in its original German. Look, not my statement, but there you go. Appreciate the email. And you can email me too, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally and I use them on the show quite often, so I look forward to that. But you know, I go back to this, and I think it's important to remember the history, because the history is being told. And the history that's being told is those factories went overseas. Those factories left the country. Those factories went out of business because of those unions. It was those unions who did it. They wanted too much. And look, the reality is anything is too much in the eyes of corporate America. If they can get it cheaper somewhere else, they're going to do it. That's the bottom line. There's nothing simpler than that. So when I see these stories, and I've heard hundreds of them, you know, people point at Bethlehem Steel a lot without actually knowing what they're talking about. Well, you know, they used to get 13 weeks vacation a year. You go, no, they didn't. Where'd you get that from? Well, I heard someone told me that someone knew. No, they didn't. They got 13 weeks vacation every 5 years. And the idea was, and this was a brilliant idea, it was only people who screwed it up. The idea was, is You get steel workers who are you know, young guys doing heavy physical manual labor who their bodies aren't going to last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. Get them to take college courses. How long is a college quarter? 13 weeks. Yeah, the local college was 13 weeks. So you went, you took the course, or two or three or whatever, and within a couple of years, you became college educated. And it was good not just for the employee, but for the employer, because a lot of people moved up into the company. In fact, you know, my ex-wife, her father, started off, you know, a guy with a shovel, worked his way up to being one of the lower management guys, made a very good living, had a very good retirement. But then what happened? And as he told me, he said, look, the reality is they spent huge amounts of money on nonsense. While the Japanese were in the factory with him, walking around, looking at how antiquated the equipment they were using was, they were going back to Japan and building state-of-the-art stuff, using new technology, as where Bethlehem Steel was using 100-year-old technology, and then taking the profits and the money that came from that and not investing it back into the business of steel, of producing more and more steel and better quality steel and more efficient and all of that, like we do today. No, no. They took it and they bought golf courses and they bought hotels and they took lavish trips and huge CEO bonuses and all kinds of stuff. You name it. Here was a guy who told me he didn't even play golf. They gave him a golf membership to one of their country clubs. He's like, I don't know which end of the stick you hit the ball with. But he had a golf club membership because that's where they wasted their money. And at the end of the road, when they destroyed themselves, where did they turn for concessions? To the people who made the profits. Not the people who wasted the profits, the people who made them. And at the end of the road, who ended up getting screwed the worst? It was those workers. When that bankruptcy judge wrote off their pension that they had worked for years and years for, with at deferred wages. One signature, one stroke of a pen. 60% of their retirement just evaporated. And where did the 40% come from? Came from we the taxpayers. Out of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. And the Bethlehem Steels of the world, they walk away and they're just one. But the frame that the right wing uses is, well, it's those greedy union workers. No, it's in those guys who are supporting their families and supporting their communities. Really? It's their fault? Ludicrous. And Buchanan's piece, for as much as I have problems with him, the majority of it, spot on. And something that every Republican voter should read. Know what your party did to this country. Know they sold you out. Every working class Republican should know this. Yet, sadly, when I talk to people, all they care about, well, you know, take my gun. No, they're taking your job, dum-dum, and they've shipped most of them out of the country. And then, when they ship your job overseas and give them a tax break to do it, I mean, doesn't that blow your mind still to this day? We just went through a whole election cycle where that was one of the main talking points. It's still in place. It's still there. So when I look at this, I can only come to the conclusion that either Republican voters are just creatures of habit and, you know, very Pavlovian, you know, they've been trained like dogs to go and pull the lever, you know, saliva, pull the lever, or they just don't care, or it's their hatred for others is so bad that their own economic interests don't matter. Because they think they're going to be okay, and I've heard that before too. I don't care what happens in the future. I'm going to be okay if I just make it another year, another 2 years. I don't care what happens. To me, that's not the American way. That's not the American viewpoint. That's not the America I grew up in. And I hope it's not the one my kids grow up in. There's so much of this that we should be fighting back against. But I tell you, you should read this Buchanan piece. Just Google how the GOP lost Middle America. It's spot on. And you know, granted, he goes into the weird immigration thing. But the information about how the Republicans lost me, really, is right on cue. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Of us, Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
I'm excited. Almost to the point of being giddy. It's a relief and just anxious to get it done.
Chattanooga, Tennessee Volkswagen worker Jonathan Walden, reacting to the news that workers in the plant will vote on whether or not to join the United Auto Workers Union. The vote is scheduled for February 12th through the 14th. VW is neutral in the organizing effort. That's important to Walden, who believes the union will win the NLRB supervised election. He says bringing the UAW into VW's Tennessee plant will be good for workers, the company, and the community, and the workers at the plant can't wait to get it done.
Oh, I'm absolutely confident. I have no doubt. The biggest reason that I want the UAW to come in is so that we, as employees of Volkswagen Chattanooga, can fully participate in the Volkswagen system. It's a system of co-determination where management and labor work together to address issues, come up with new ideas, to innovate, just to help move the company forward.
UAW President Bob King says VW is known globally for its system of cooperation with unions and works councils, and the UAW wants to partner with VW and a works council to set a new standard in the U.S. for innovative labor management relations that benefits all involved. Works councils are used in Germany, but if the workers win and the UAW is authorized to represent them in Chattanooga, this would be the first works council in the U.S. King vowed when elected president of the UAW in 2010 to organize at least one of the foreign-owned auto plants in the South. Anti-union groups are worried that if workers at VW go UAW, other auto plants in the South will follow. Unlike many union organizing drives, this employer is not waging an anti-union campaign. And VW called on all third parties to honor the principle of neutrality. The $8.7 billion cut in food stamps that just passed the U.S. House targets mostly blue states controlled by Democrats. Nearly all of the cuts will come from 16 states that voted for Obama. 28 of the 32 senators are Democrats, so the cuts are targeted overwhelmingly at poor people living in these blue states. Food stamps, known as the SNAP program, were boosted in the wake of the Great Recession of 2008-09. The boost is going away along with more cuts. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, that will leave SNAP benefits for 2013 at less than $1.40 per person per meal. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers has reached a tentative agreement with Alaska Airlines on a new labor contract for 2,500 clerical office and passenger service workers. The agreement includes paces and job security provisions. The members will be voting on whether or not to ratify the new contract, and the ratification results are expected in early April.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Yeah, like it always is. You know, the special interests, they seem to always get their way. Those who live in their gated communities with access to people like our governor, with huge checks to be handed out, take from education, take from infrastructure, take from the future, they hand out big tax breaks to corporations. The future be damned, I guess. It is what it is, which is why we've asked Philip Matera. He's a research director of the Good Jobs First. They've just put out a new report putting state pension costs into context. Now, we've heard it's the end of the world. The sky's falling tomorrow. $42 billion unfunded liability. And we hear this in states all across the country, which is why I think it's great that the Good Jobs First did this report, which why I'm grateful that Philip came and talked to us. Philip, thanks for being here.
Happy to be with you.
So I look at this report that you guys have put out. I think it's stuff that we've already talked about. We've already known that we're giving away huge amounts of money to these big companies at the expense of investments and pensions and in health care and other things. Is that what your study came across?
Yeah, well, what we tried to do is provide a kind of a response to those people who look at pension costs in isolation. And as you say that, you know, the sky is falling, pension costs are out of control. So what we do is, in this report, is compare state pension costs in Pennsylvania and in 9 other states to the amount of revenue that states are losing each year from corporate subsidies, corporate tax breaks, loopholes, tax loopholes used by corporations. And what we find is that in every one of these states, the amount of revenue loss from those subsidies and tax breaks far outweighs the current cost of providing pension benefits for state workers. So, you know, if there's any kind of fiscal crisis, it's really the crisis stemming from the fact that corporations are kind of getting away with murder and not paying their fair share, rather than the modest pensions that state workers receive.
Yeah, it's not just getting away with it. They're walking away with tons of it. And you use the word lost. That's revenue that's been lost. I would say it's revenue and money that's been given away. I mean, I look at our governor here in Pennsylvania, and I know it's the same in a number of other states where they've kowtowed to corporate America, going, here, we'll give you a pot of gold if you'll come and pretend like you're creating jobs, without any real look at if they're actually creating the jobs.
Right, or would they have created those jobs without the subsidies?
Exactly.
I mean, you know, your state gave $1.6 billion to Royal Dutch Shell, you know, the largest, you know, one of the largest corporations in the world, you know, to build that cracker facility. You know, in all likelihood, I mean, Shell didn't really need the money. I mean, they'll take it, you know, if they can get it.
Sweetens the pot.
Yeah. But
you know, the thing is in this, you hit on an important part, because I've been told by people who do location work, that's their gig, they're location specialists, they said that that place was the place where it's going was probably the only place in the tri-state area that it could have gone, because after all, the gas is in Pennsylvania. It's not like you can go, to Michigan or to, you know, to Illinois to do it. It's here.
Right. But, you know, public officials, either because, you know, they're unduly influenced by private interests or they're just naive, think that they have to throw all this money at companies. You know, when companies are supposed, you know, there's all this talk about business, you know, about risk-taking. Companies are supposed to be taking risks. Well, public officials, in effect, are taking the risk out of a lot of these projects by just throwing taxpayer money at the companies.
And one of the things that you pointed out, to bring it to Pennsylvania, is, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, that the money that we're giving away to these companies, 2.5 times what it was for us to make the payments into our pension system. Do I have that right?
Right. Well, we compared to what we call the current pension cost, which is what it costs to provide the benefits on an ongoing basis. And we don't, in the report, we focus on that rather than on the issue of paying for past underfunding.
So right. So here in Pennsylvania,
two and a half times the current cost.
Okay.
Is what the state is losing, or as you say, giving away in subsidies and tax breaks. But even if you bring in the underfunding issue, the amount that the state is supposed to be putting into the pot each year, still, the tax breaks and the subsidies significantly outweigh, you know, the total pension costs.
So could you argue then that this is creating a crisis that really shouldn't be there if we were using the resource that we have in a better fashion?
Well, you know, pensions are obligations that were, you know, been made to public employees over the years. You know, a lot of people go into the public sector, you know, with the understanding that their pay may not be as high as in the private sector, at least this is traditionally the case, and, you know, but they were going to get, you know, a better, you know, more secure pension. And that was kind of the trade-off.
Right.
Right. You got a decent pension, you know, maybe your salary, your wages weren't, you know, quite as high as they would otherwise have been. Now public officials are basically, you know, in breach of that contract. You know, that was an agreement that was made. Now they're suddenly saying, well, sorry, we can't really afford to meet our obligations. And, you know, I understand that Governor Corbett has been talking about, you know, various options. He wanted to kind of replace traditional pensions with a 401k. Now he's talking about some kind of hybrid system. But the point is that these pensions are things that were promised to public employees, people worked for over, you know, many years. Can't just kind of pull the rug out from under people.
Oh, sure we can, Philip. You know, look what corporate America has gotten away with for at least two generations. And the sad reality is I know so many people who have had their pensions stolen from them because you had corporate America run them through bankruptcy, and a bankruptcy judge just goes, okay, PBGC for you, and that's the end of it. And I've been saying for a while what we're seeing, and maybe you'll disagree, but what we're seeing is state leaders like Corbett and elsewhere going, we're going to run government like a business, which means that bankruptcy route. And hey, sorry, it was nice while you thought you had it, but we're like we did to the private sector, we're taking it away.
Well, that's literally happening in Detroit, right?
Exactly.
So, you know, in a sense, what's going on in Pennsylvania and other states is analogous, you know, to what the private sector has done. In Detroit, they're literally, you know, following that pattern.
So what do we do? I mean, you know, we're being told all the time the sky's falling from California and Arizona to Michigan to Missouri to right here in Pennsylvania. We're told the sky's falling. It's we have this massive here in Pennsylvania. They keep telling us $47 billion unfunded liability, like everybody's going to retire tomorrow. But you know, they keep throwing it out, and huge numbers scare people, I think.
Yeah, well, remember the current cost. You know, it was more like $1.4 billion. And that was even the figure, you know, I checked that Corbett used in his budget message. I think he used $1.5 billion. But, you know, as we point out, the state is giving away a lot more than that each year in the subsidies and tax breaks. So, I mean, there's no easy political answer to this, but I think the first step is just to, you know, kind of challenge the sky is falling rhetoric. You know, that's why we call this report, you know, just putting the state pension costs in context. I think once you begin to look at these amounts in relation to other things like the giveaways to corporations, it's a little harder for the other side to continue with the hysterical rhetoric. And, you know, I mean, the hope is that this will put them on the defensive a little bit and make them see that, you know, pensions are not the kind of disastrous situation that they want to depict them as.
No, I mean, personally, I think we should be opening up the state pension system to all workers and thus getting more people involved in it to make it more solvent longer down the road so that everyone has a stake in the game and that we don't just divide people off so we can, because that's what happens in this country too often. They slice and dice and they divide people up, and that these folks are the ones we're going after today. Without understanding that, you know, eventually all of us are in the shark tank, and the shark eventually takes a bite out of all of our behinds.
Yeah. And, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, another way that I believe Corbett is kind of following the private sector is by making future workers bear the brunt,
yes,
you know, of some of these policies, you know, because it's harder for people who are not yet on the job to defend themselves. You know, just as in the private sector, you know, these kind of two-tier wage systems, you know, undercut, you know, the future living standards and job security of, you know, of workers. You know, the kind of proposals to deteriorate pensions, you know, for future public employees, you know, has the same disastrous effect.
So let me ask you last line of questioning, because we see this, again, all over the country. Now it's this huge problem. And I'm sure a lot of states like Pennsylvania for years didn't contribute. And I guess our governor's talking about maybe not making full contribution this year. I'm not sure. But, you know, when you look at this and you see these states who have done this stuff over the years, putting this into context, this is not the huge crisis that they've made it out to be, is it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's the same thing with Social Security. I mean, the other side, you know, wants to create a kind of crisis atmosphere to justify, you know, radical changes in policies. So, you know, I think you've got to, you know, first question, you know, their claims about there being a crisis, and then it's easier to challenge, you know, their radical, you know, reactionary radical proposals.
Yeah, I mean, Governor Corbett's proposal, his own economists came in and testified that the governor's own proposal would make things much worse. But and the argument, and I love this, the argument is, yes, it would make things much worse, but we should do it because it's the right thing. Because ideologically, it's what the at the Cato Institute or the American Enterprise Institute or one of those think tanks that came out and testified for them, it's what we believe in. So even though it's going to be much more costly, it's still the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Which is nuts to me. Just nuts. Anyway, the report, putting state pension costs into context, we've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Philip Matera's name. Philip, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Same here. Happy to do so.
Thanks so much. Phil is the research director over at Good Jobs First. And again, you can get to the report at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Phil's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents, you may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
I've noticed that local celebrations of Martin Luther King Day tend to be unique, for they've generally not been turned into yet another excuse for beer and barbecue parties. Rather than trivialize the meaning of this courageous man's life, most people treat the day as a moment of serious reflection. Many even memorialize it by vowing to confront the powers that be on some of the big issues that Reverend King asked America to redress, such as entrenched racial inequality and the exploitation of poverty wage workers. But now, I've learned that joining the gritty struggle for justice is not the proper way to honor King. No, no, 'tis a far better thing you do if you just traipse down to a local McDonald's outlet, order a Happy Meal, and join the joyous, integrated Golden Arches family in singing a few verses of Kumbaya. At least, that's what the world's largest hamburger chain urged us to do in a shameless PR campaign. It used this year's MLK Day to try whitewashing its own sorry record of worker mistreatment. One full-page ad pictured three McDonald's crew members, each one a person of color, beaming with delight above ad copy that extolled the corporation's commitment to, quote, a diverse and inclusive workforce. I think Dr. King would have upchucked and asked, What about a workforce that's paid a living wage with benefits so they don't have to work second or third jobs and go on food stamps to subsidize the labor costs of this miserly, super-rich fast food empire? The touchy-feely ad turned to total squish at the end, calling on all Americans to embrace their differences. We can't imagine a better way to honor King's Day than by doing just that. This is Jim Hightower saying, Dr. King, however, had a sharper imagination than that. He would have helped the workers unionize McDonald's to gain real justice for themselves.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Isn't that what it means to be an American? Isn't that it? To fight for what's right, to fight for the downtrodden, the poor, the folks who need the help. Isn't that it? I mean, isn't that what it's to be American? Fight for the underdog? Really? I mean, stop and think about that. I look at this governor's budget. Not it at all. And the priorities put forth are, you know, this idea that we're going to enrich the very well-to-do at the expense of everyone else. Is just, to me, ludicrous. And the fact that, and you know, I just did an interview with the folks at Politico, who wanted, the woman contacted me, said she wanted to do a piece on the show. And I said, yeah, fine, great, you know, I'm not against the idea. And she's like, you know, what do you think, you know, why'd you start this? You know, why is it important? And I said, you know, look, at the end of the day, everything that we've been told is wrong. You know, you go back and, you know, like I said earlier, all of the manufacturing jobs that were lost in this country during the 80s and 90s, the mouthpieces of the wealth class are pointing the fingers at workers. It's their fault they wanted too much. They demanded wages, hours, conditions. They demanded safe working conditions. They demanded pensions. They demanded health care. How dare they? They demanded opportunity for their kids. And look, corporate America said enough. We're not giving you any more. We're taking our ball and we're going home. And in the process, it's not just a matter of taking your ball and go home. In the process, we're going to rig the game so badly that you're never going to get your own ball. Because that's what's happened with these trade deals. We have taken all the risk out of a huge multinational corporate special interest. We have taken the risk out of that game. And we've heavily subsidized it. Now, mom and pops, look, I'm a small business guy. I'm a firm believer in competition. I'm a firm believer in local. I'm a firm believer in, you know, the guy who makes the best widget should do well. But in the process, should be paying his workers well as well. What they've done is they've said, no, we're taking our ball. We're going to Vietnam or to China or in Indonesia or Sri Lanka or who knows where. Good luck. Spin the map. Find it. And then we're going to bring all of this stuff back. And good luck, American corporation, to compete against us, because we'll crush you. Not only will we crush you with cheap labor and no environmental standards, we're going to crush you with deregulation language and, our friends in high places. This is why I keep going, you know, hey, Republicans, you need to wake up. And this is why, honestly, at the very beginning of the Tea Party, at the very beginning when there was that spark of outrage that I said, yes, finally, someone's got it. There were a few voices that weren't insane, that were saying the stuff that I've been saying. Look, our manufacturing policy is horrible. It's killing the American workforce. It's killing the middle class. Our trade policies are destructive for everybody but Wall Street. We should be doing something about that. This push towards deregulation, this push towards insanely low taxes on the very wealthy. We shouldn't be going down this path. And at the very beginning of the Tea Party, there were some voices that were saying these things. quickly they got expelled. Quickly they got sent to the, summarily dismissed and sent to the closet because the moneyed interests took over. And with their control of talk radio and their control of the media, they kept pushing this, the red meat. Said, oh no, it's these unions. Oh, it's government. You'll be mad at government. It's their fault. And look, government's a tool. Understand that. Government is a tool. It's how we use it. It's how we allow it to be used. It's how, and this just blows my mind that so many people that I've met just throw up their hands and say, there's nothing we can do. We live in a country where you're damn right there's something we can do. We can elect people like us, but we never seem to do that, do we? We always seem to go for the guy who's got the money, right? Oh, well, he's got money. He must know something. Yeah, he knows how to get money, and he knows how to buy advertisement, and he knows how to do these things that, you know, honest, decent, hardworking Americans don't do. So when you look at very simple issues like, you know, raising the minimum wage, I don't know any working person who's against raising the minimum wage. I don't know any wage earner who says, no, the minimum wage is too high. I don't. Now, I look in California. California is looking at increasing their minimum wage to $11 an hour in 2015, $12 in 2016, and $13 in 2017. And then from that point on, it will be tied to increases in inflation beginning in 2018. It will be the highest minimum wage in the country. And I think that's a step in the right direction. Now, of course, you're going to have the right-wingers of the, well, I'll just make it $100 an hour. Well, nobody's saying that. I'm saying if there's a federal minimum wage that is below the poverty line, there's a problem with your minimum wage. I look at the good state of Washington, which I got to give Washington credit. They're on the forefront of fighting for workers' rights. A lawmaker in Washington state has proposed a piece of legislation requiring businesses in Washington to give their workers paid vacations. Yeah, it would be the very first of its kind in the nation to demand that. Now, understand, here in Pennsylvania, the Republicans who control our General Assembly, they're pushing a piece of legislation right now as we speak, House Bill 1960. They are pushing it right now to say that local municipalities, Harrisburg, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Carlisle, Allentown, whatever, illegal for you to pass a paid sick day ordinance or a vacation day ordinance or any paid ordinance whatsoever. They want to, you know, the people who tell us that they believe in local control, they want to consolidate power in the hands of the state. Which, you know, you can see the irony in that, can't you? Of course you can. But I think it's amazing that Washington State is going, you know, hey, we've got all of these workers here who don't have vacation time. Now, you go to other countries, especially our more developed industrial nations around the world, most of Europe, Germany, all of these countries. I met a guy when I was on vacation from Germany. Started a job with 30 days vacation. Started the day, 30 days vacation, 4 weeks vacation. And the idea, understand, because this is something we've got to really be thinking about in the coming years. As jobs continue to shrink, as they mechanize and more technology takes over, and we have an increase in the population because you're going to continue to grow, jobs are not going to grow as fast as the demographics are going to. It's just reality. So we've got to figure out, you know, how is it that we make sure that folks, oh, I don't know, can exist on lower wages, on lower number of hours. Maybe we look at, you know, more vacation time to get more people jobs. A lot of this stuff, things we should be talking about. But, you know, I give Washington State credit. It will be interesting, and this will be something that I follow in the coming weeks and months because, to me, that big step in the right direction. In fact, Washington also recently took a step towards making sure that workers can take paid time off. You know, and this is another thing I've been talking about. You know, we need to make sure that there's paid sick leave. You know, it was all fine, well, and good that Clinton passed the Family Medical Leave Act. Yeah, it was all wonderful. Yeah, it was great. Fabulous. But if you can't afford to take the day off, if you can't afford to live without the day's pay, what good is it? And, you know, I've known so many people over the years who, you know, when my kids were born, I was fortunate. I had a good enough job that I was able to save some money. So when my kids were born, I was able to take, I think I took eight with my oldest daughter. I think I took six or seven with each of the other two. But we were able to save, and I was able to spend those weeks with them. To me, that's just, well, that's family values. And I find it interesting that the party who claims to be the party of family values isn't backing it. Doesn't it seem odd to you? It is what it is. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
A union man, brother firefighter, my friend. Had the kids locked in the Capitol, I'm fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, a union town. All down the line, this is a union town, a union town. All down the line, and if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, a union town. All down the line.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we bear.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
I'm excited. Almost to the point of being giddy. It's a relief and just anxious to get it done.
Chattanooga, Tennessee Volkswagen worker Jonathan Walden, reacting to the news that workers in the plant will vote on whether or not to join the United Auto Workers Union. The vote is scheduled for February 12th through the 14th. VW is neutral in the organizing effort. That's important to Walden, who believes the union will win the NLRB supervised election. He says bringing the UAW into VW's Tennessee plant will be good for workers, the company, and the community, and the workers at the plant can't wait to get it done.
Oh, I'm absolutely confident. I have no doubt. The biggest reason I want the UAW to come in is so that we, as employees of Volkswagen Chattanooga, can fully participate in the Volkswagen system. It's a system of co-determination where management and labor work together to address issues, come up with new ideas, to innovate, just to help move the company forward.
UAW President Bob King says VW is known globally for its system of cooperation with unions and works councils, and the UAW wants to partner with VW and a works council to set a new standard in the U.S. for innovative labor-management relations that benefits all involved. Works councils are used in Germany, but if the workers win and the UAW is authorized to represent them in Chattanooga, this would be the first works council in the U.S. King vowed when elected president of the UAW in 2010 to organize at least one of the foreign-owned auto plants in the South. Anti-union groups are worried that if workers at VW go UAW, other auto plants in the South will follow. Unlike many union organizing drives, this employer is not waging an anti-union campaign. And VW called on all third parties to honor the principle of neutrality. The $8.7 billion cut in food stamps that just passed the U.S. House targets mostly blue states controlled by Democrats. Nearly all of the cuts will come from 16 states that voted for Obama. 28 of the 32 senators are Democrats, so the cuts are targeted overwhelmingly at poor people living in these blue states. Food stamps, known as the SNAP program, were boosted in the wake of the Great Recession of 2008-09. The boost is going away along with more cuts. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, that will leave SNAP benefits for 2013 at less than $1.40 per person per meal. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers has reached a tentative agreement with Alaska Airlines on a new labor contract for 2,500 clerical office and passenger service workers. The agreement includes pay raises and job security provisions. The members will be voting on whether or not to ratify the new contract, and the ratification results are expected in early April.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Every now and then I visit an elementary school. Talking with children is a pretty good idea, I think. They ask questions we don't think about, and they ask them very directly. Recently, a little girl wanted to know, what's the hardest part of your job? That got me thinking. I looked down and I told her, the hardest part is telling people no.
I got to be honest. And the question is which people is he saying no to? And which who are the hard ones? Because you look at the last 3 years, he didn't have a hard time saying no to our children, didn't have a hard time saying no to our infrastructure, no to low-wage workers when he kicked them off of adult basic, didn't have any problem doing that, didn't seem to have any problem eviscerating the general assistance budget that kicks 70,000 of our most vulnerable to the curb. No, didn't have much of a problem saying no on that front. So I guess the question is, who's he having a hard time saying no to? Anyway, today was the big speech, the big budget speech, election year campaigning. Got to soften the blow a little bit. Here to talk a little bit about that is Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Sterla. Mike, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure, thanks for having me on.
So what'd you think of the big speech today?
Well, it was a pretty lame campaign speech is the way I would characterize it.
As I tweeted out, I was extremely underwhelmed.
Yeah. Here's a guy who has cut $1 billion from education the first year, cut nearly $1 billion the second year, cut nearly $1 billion the third year, and this year decides to throw a couple $100 million at it and say, see, I'm for education. Well, you know, he's still a couple $1 billion shy of where he was when he started. Same way as you pointed out with, health care. I mean, now suddenly he's for health care, but not this year, next year, if he gets his waiver, which nobody believes he will. And he's consistently been against improving the health care for Pennsylvanians. We have an opportunity for 500,000 people to have health care tomorrow if he just accepts Medicaid expansion, like every other governor has in every state that surrounds us. So then with that, it's education, health care, and on jobs, his boast was that we almost have as many jobs back as we lost during the recession. Other states have surpassed that, and then some have surpluses in their budgets and are moving forward, and we're still trying to catch up.
What was interesting to me when I was listening to the speech, his big job creation plan is more tax cuts, it seemed, because for the next governor, and I find it very interesting that the next governor is going to be saddled with the end of the cap and the franchise tax, the capital stock and franchise tax, which he ends in the next term, which very many people believe that he's going to be that guy, but that really sticks it to the people down the road. And you look at the huge tax breaks he's given out to other big companies, Royal Dutch Shell, $1.7 billion over the next 25 years. It just seems like we're giving away our future's money now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in one sense, it almost looks like he's a governor that has conceded the fact that he's not going to be the next governor and is doing his last gasp at trying to push the policies that have gotten us to the sort of lackadaisical, poor performing state that we have right now. More of the same. What's the old thing? The definition of insanity is to, continue to do the same thing and expect a different result.
Yep.
We're still lagging behind the national average on job creation. And he says, yes, I'm going to do more of the same because if you just stick it out long enough, eventually we'll get there. I'm not sure what he bases that on, but it certainly can't be the job numbers or the performance of the economy here in Pennsylvania in the last 3 years.
I said it from the very beginning, if the belt tightening is going to help us down the road, and they really believe that us tightening our belt and cutting back is going to help a brighter future, then, if you have to do it, you have to do it, because we in the working class are used to that. We're usually saddled with all of the repercussions of bad decisions by our leaders and our corporate titans. But I don't see the massive belt tightening. I don't see the harm to our social safety net as helping us in any way, shape, or form. And I think, to highlight what you said, we've actually moved pretty far backwards.
Yeah. And like you said, look, if people said, we just have to do more with less, and, the tax cuts to out-of-state corporations has produced massive amounts of jobs in the state of Pennsylvania, and things are going gangbusters here, I'd go, Well, eat my words. He was right. But the exact opposite has happened. And he insists on staying down that road. And, I think with the notion that if he's not going to be here next year, he's at least going to have enough favors passed out that, he'll find himself a job once he leaves here.
Yeah, and then he can go to his house in South Carolina, which I'm okay with. But, here's the thing that gets me. If the Marcellus Shale job creator is that great? I mean, if it's so booming, how is it that we're so far behind all the other states? How is it that if giving out all this money, and we've been giving out huge amounts of money at the expense of our future, if that's the case, if all this stuff's working, why aren't the jobs there?
Well, I mean, I think that's the central issue here. On jobs, on education, on healthcare, there's been abysmal performance numbers. And again, that's why I say, I mean, this was a campaign speech by all accounts, in the sense that he now claims that he's actually trying to do something about all those issues.
Right.
Like, suddenly 3 years later, there was a light bulb that went off at the back of the refrigerator somewhere, and my gosh, guess what? We got to do some things here in the state of Pennsylvania. After he's ignored those issues for 3 years, and in this budget isn't really doing anything to correct them, it's just, you know, he's now acknowledging that there's a problem.
Let me ask you this, Mike. You know, as someone who was sitting in the and they're listening to the governor give his speech in the room, it didn't sound like, for me, from listening online, that, you know, even his big points, the few that he tried to make, were received with any sort of real enthusiasm. I mean, it seemed to me like the Republicans were going, well, okay, that wasn't great.
Yeah.
It didn't seem like it was well received even by the most faithful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you compare it to last year's budget address, where I think he got something like six applause lines and actually stopped to take drinks of water to give people a chance to applaud, and they didn't. I think he made sure there were enough plants in the room that there was applause at least this time. But as you point out, it was nothing enthusiastic and, you know, nobody hooting and hollering and cheering about, you know, his proposals. When you talk about cutting education by $1 billion for 3 years in a row and then say, oh, and by the way, I'm going to increase the one line item a little bit, nobody's getting too excited about it. You know, when you say you're going to eventually do something about health care and you've taken people off the health care rolls in the state of Pennsylvania, I don't think anybody's too excited about it.
Yeah.
When you say, hey, I know we haven't quite created enough jobs, but I'm concerned about jobs and I'm going to continue to work on jobs if you just, you know, let me continue to work on jobs. Eventually people go, what are you talking about? What is the plan here? Other than somebody else can take care of it. If I just make sure that they don't have to pay any taxes, I'm sure they'll do something about it.
You know, one of the things I heard him say, and maybe I heard it wrong, but he said that they've been working to protect physicians from trial lawyers. And I said, well, what about protecting we the citizens? What about protecting the patients? Did I hear that right? I mean, because maybe it was just a bad line. Maybe it was delivered poorly. But it sounded like, you know, we the people, screw you. We got our special interest.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the thing is that the governor and Republicans in the House and Senate have sort of hung their hat on the fact that they've nibbled around the edges at some of their ideological issues that they've pushed for years. I think they're trying to court their base back, because even their base is disgruntled and disenfranchised. I don't think that's enough. I think it's too little too late in an election year, and people see it for what it is. Even the so-called supporters look at it and go, really? That's what you say we have to claim as an accomplishment? Not much.
Yeah. You know, he brought up our seniors deserve better care, which I found to be kind of disingenuous, given the fact that here's a guy who is trying to privatize one of the main streams of revenue that take care of our seniors, the lottery. And I look at this and I go, you know, is there a disconnect? Because I didn't see anybody else really picking up on the fact that, here's a guy who's trying to give away hundreds of millions of dollars to a private corporation overseas that our seniors could have benefited from.
Yeah. I think there's a true disconnect. If you talk to the people in Pennsylvania, and, you know, whether it's by looking at a poll and seeing where, you know, opinions are, or whether it's just going and talking to people on the street, I think they have moved beyond this governor. This governor is still stuck with his ideological bent on how he wants to lead this state backwards. And I think the public has moved on beyond that. The hope is that we can craft some sort of budget between now and then that starts to move the state forward in spite of him, with the notion that he won't be here next year come budget time. And I think the people of Pennsylvania are ready for that. You know, if he forces himself upon us for one more budget cycle here, you know, the hope is that we can at least keep him from doing more damage.
Yeah, I heard him mention inequality all of, well, zero times. I heard him mention minimum wage, raising the minimum wage to help workers, low-wage workers. I heard him mention that all of zero times. There are things that I think we should be doing that, from a policy position, this governor and his ilk are adamantly opposed to, and, you know, to my view, to the detriment of our economy.
Yeah, you know, there are some basic things that have been proven over time. If you do strategic investments, if you, you know, make sure that the working class has a living wage, if you make sure that there are health care benefits so people don't go into bankruptcy as a result of, you know, not being able to pay their health care bills, you know, those types of things. If you make sure that people's, you know, don't get taxed out of their homes because their local taxes went up so much because of lack of funding for education in the state of Pennsylvania. If you, you know, talk about kids that finally get a decent education because they were able to afford it and they had good teachers and, you know, there weren't 40 kids in a classroom. All those things are things that he's basically ignored and said, no, we're going in a different direction.
Well, let me ask you this, Mike Sterling. You know, as you look at this budget, and I view budgets as a moral document. It's your priorities. It's who you are inside. It's the values that one holds that they put forth. In looking at it from that frame, where do you put this governor in view of morality, of our priorities? Whose priorities is he looking out for?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've been trying to figure that out for 4 years. Look, a budget really is about your morals and your priorities, and it's attaching numbers to those. And those numbers speak volumes about where you place those priorities. Today he talked about education and basically, you know, claimed that because he's doing a tiny bit, because there's a few crumbs that he's willing to put on the table now, the fact that he sliced off half the loaf in the last 3 years doesn't matter.
He got federal money, and he took some race to the top money, which I found interesting.
Yeah. You know, I mean, again, when someone else uses federal dollars, it's, a terrible thing. When he uses it, he's, you know, coming back to save education. Well, you know, I'm glad that he's willing to use those dollars. And you know, I'm glad that we're going to get a little bit, or at least he's willing to say that he's not going to completely, you know, insist that there be another cut to education. But, you know, don't paint yourself as the education governor, you know. It's utterly disingenuous.
I agree with you. Last question I've got for you. You know, I look at this and the priorities, I think, you know, when you look at the, you know, a lot of people say there's not much difference between the two parties. I see in this budgeting process, I see what this governor's proposed and what I've heard others on the Democratic side say, completely different. Can you give us a number of the differences that you think a Democratic governor next time around would focus on that this guy didn't?
Well, I mean, first off, I think we'd be looking at making sure that there are more people that have health insurance in the state of Pennsylvania instead of less. I think we'd be looking to make sure that the state is doing more of their fair share to fund education in this state, and making sure that the priorities are such that we actually have a funding formula that makes sense so that we're not just pushing dollars to some of the wealthiest schools and starving poor schools in the rural and urban parts of this state. I think you'd be making sure that there's the governor would be making sure that we'd be looking at strategic investments in job creation as opposed to just blanket tax cuts for all businesses, regardless of whether or not they create any jobs or not. This notion that every business will just create jobs if you give them a tax break, some of them will actually just go to the Cayman Islands and vacation.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, that view of we give them enough money, they've got to do something with it, right?
Yeah, right.
And they do. They leave. And, you know, I was glad when we talked yesterday with the Auditor General, who said he's right now doing an audit, an investigation of just that, looking at how much money that we've given out to these companies who, you know, the one I saw move from Phillipsburg, New Jersey, across the river to Easton, Pennsylvania. We gave them millions of dollars for that big move. Was that job creation or was that just stealing from New Jersey? I guess that's something to look at. But I was happy to hear the Auditor General was looking into that.
Yeah. Auditor General DePasquale has been doing a great job in terms of, bringing some of these issues to light. I think in for the most part, we've had, Democrats throughout the state that have been willing to step forward and say, I'm sorry, I beg to differ with your analysis of what's going on here. Today I thought in the budget that I was hearing that, we were back to, a new math where less money for education is actually an increase, where job losses were actually job increases, where an unemployment rate that's below the national average was something to cheer about, that's higher than the national average was something to cheer about. It was sort of an Alice in Wonderland kind of speech.
Well, if you defund education enough and we destroy critical thinking enough, it will be.
Yeah, yeah.
It is what it is. Mike, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time and giving us your thoughts and your ideas and on the big speech. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, Mike Sterla, Democratic representative in the State House. A quick break, right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I've noticed that local celebrations of Martin Luther King Day tend to be unique, for they've generally not been turned into yet another excuse for beer and barbecue parties. Rather than trivialize the meaning of this courageous man's life, most people treat the day as a moment of serious reflection. Many even memorialize it by vowing to confront the powers that be on some of the big issues that Reverend King asked America to redress, such as entrenched racial inequality and the exploitation of poverty wage workers. But now, I've learned that joining the gritty struggle for justice is not the proper way to honor King. No, no, 'tis a far better thing you do if you just traipse down to a local McDonald's outlet, order a Happy Meal, and join the joyous, integrated Golden Arches family in singing a few verses of Kumbaya. At least, that's what the world's largest hamburger chain urged us to do in a shameless PR campaign. It used this year's MLK Day to try whitewashing its own sorry record of worker mistreatment. One full-page ad pictured three McDonald's crew members, each one a person of color, beaming with delight above ad copy that extolled the corporation's commitment to, quote, a diverse and inclusive workforce. I think Dr. King would have upchucked and asked, what about a workforce that's paid a living wage with benefits so they don't have to work second or third jobs and go on food stamps to subsidize the labor costs of this miserly, super-rich fast food empire? The touchy-feely ad turned a total squish at the end, calling on all Americans to embrace their differences. We can't imagine a better way to honor King's Day than by doing just that. This is Jim Hightower saying, Dr. King, however, had a sharper imagination than that. He would have helped the workers unionize McDonald's to gain real justice for themselves.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. During the break, Michelle sent me an email highlighting what I was just saying a minute ago, highlighting what I was saying in the segment before, that the frame has been that all of the job losses are because of those evil unions, because those workers, they wanted more. She sent me this email that Evidently, this, and I love these names. Oh, you gotta love the euphemistically named right wing attack hate think groups. You gotta love this. Center for Worker Freedom. Oh, I love that. Like we actually, like they care about workers. Now, understand, they're another one of these, you know, wealth class flacks. Who, you know, out there doing what they're doing. Now, the Center for Worker Freedom is just a subgroup, from what I understand, of the Americans for Tax Reform group. The Grover Norquist folks. You know, the most powerful man in Pennsylvania, Grover Norquist. No tax increases. Evidently, the good folks there at the Center for Worker Freedom, again, like they care, they've spent a boatload of cash fighting against the workers at Volkswagen, at the Tennessee plant there in Volkswagen, from joining the UAW. And they've taken out huge billboards, one that says, instead of United Auto Workers, it's United Obama Workers. The UAW, they say, spends millions of dollars to elect liberal politicians, including Barack Obama. And I'm surprised they didn't throw the Hussein in there. That would have been a class touch. Especially for a group like that. Now, they're spending $15 million to go after this. They've also put up another billboard that says, quote, almost every job lost at U.S. car factories in the last 30 years has occurred at unionized companies. Now, that has nothing to do with the workers. That has everything to do with the company and the bad decisions by management and the weakness of our labor laws. The scare tactics, and it's going to be interesting to see where this vote goes. It's going to be interesting to see if the workers at the Volkswagen plant there in Chattanooga, Tennessee, step forward and say, you know what, we want to have the voice. And, you know, we've had some folks on the program over the last couple of months who, you know, have said, look, you know, we want that voice like they have in Germany. We want a determination of where the company is going to go. And that's, understand, what corporate America doesn't want, what the wealth class doesn't want, the people who fund the Americans for tax relief or for, you know, whatever their name is. Tax reform. Thank you. Whoever's funding them, they don't want people to you to have a voice. They don't want workers to have any say whatsoever. Do what you're told or you'll be fired. That's what they want you to understand. That's it. Bottom line. And, you know, I give these guys in Tennessee credit. In the face of all of this opposition, in the face of what has got to be a very hostile environment, because if you remember Zach Wamm, you know, Zach said, you know, Volkswagen invested in Tennessee, right to work state. Less health care, less payment, you know, less all that stuff. And let's not forget the $1 billion from the taxpayers of Tennessee. Let's not forget that. Now these guys are saying, you know what, hey, you know, we want to have something of a voice. We'd like some self-determination. We'd like a say in our wages, hours, our conditions. We'd like a say in how things are done. To me, that's pretty powerful stuff in a place like Tennessee. Now, if this can go on in Tennessee, and this is where the Americans for Tax Reform, the billionaire front group, along with their sub-front group, and I love this, the billionaires have a front group who then create a front group, and on and on, and they come up with these wonderful names, Center for Worker Freedom, love that. There's no freedom, understand that. But they sent out these flags out there with millions of dollars to whip people into a frenzy in states like Tennessee, where I can't imagine where the special interest money pouring in has got to be scaring the hell out of people. I mean, I would have put the Hussein in there. I would have, just because it enrages people, because we're basically, some of us are led around by the tips of our nose. But it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see where this goes. I'm guardedly optimistic that these workers are going to step forward, which could mean a whole wave of organizing. And what the wealth class is afraid of is if in Tennessee people are seen as organizing, that wave could go across the country. And boy, would that be bad. That would be just horrible for them. Because if people start feeling empowered, if people start feeling like, hey, we can do this, it's going to spread. And this is what the wealth class has been afraid of for a while. This recession has really got people looking up and going, hey, we're getting screwed in this. We're getting ripped off. We're the ones struggling. We're the one eating the store brand you-know-what or this or that. I don't see the wealth class of this country struggling. I don't see the shared sacrifice, even though they keep saying, oh, you know, shared sacrifice. I'm not seeing it. So I'm looking forward to this, and I'm sure, you know, within the next several days we'll have some news, and when we do, right here on the program. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com, Stitcher on the smartphone. Appreciate you being here. Appreciate the input. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
I'm excited. How much is going to be in getting? It's a relief and just anxious to get it done.
Chattanooga, Tennessee Volkswagen worker Jonathan Walden reacting to the news that workers in the plant will vote on whether or not to join the United Auto Workers Union. The vote is scheduled for February 12th through the 14th. VW is neutral in the organizing effort. That's important to Walden, who believes the union will win the NLRB supervised election. He says bringing the UAW into VW's Tennessee plant will be good for workers, the company, and the community, and the workers at the plant can't wait to get it done.
Oh, I'm absolutely confident. I have no doubt. The biggest reason that I want the UAW to come in is so that we, as employees of Volkswagen Chattanooga, can fully participate in the Volkswagen system. It's a system of co-determination where management and labor work together to address issues, come up with new ideas, to innovate, just to help move the company forward.
UAW President Bob King says VW is known globally for its system of cooperation with unions and works councils, and the UAW wants to partner with VW and a works council to set a new standard in the U.S. for innovative labor management relations that benefits all involved. Works councils are used in Germany, but if the workers win and the UAW is authorized to represent them in Chattanooga, this would be the first works council in the U.S. King vowed when elected president of the UAW in 2010 to organize at least one of the foreign-owned auto plants in the South. Anti-union groups are worried that if workers at VW go UAW, other auto plants in the South will follow. Unlike many union organizing drives, this employer is not waging an anti-union campaign. And VW called on all third parties to honor the principle of neutrality. The $8.7 billion cut in food stamps that just passed the U.S. House targets mostly blue states controlled by Democrats. Nearly all of the cuts will come from 16 states that voted for Obama. 28 of the 32 senators are Democrats, so the cuts are targeted overwhelmingly at poor people living in these blue states. Food stamps, known as the SNAP program, were boosted in the wake of the Great Recession of 2008-09. The boost is going away along with more cuts. According to the Center on Budget and Policies, that will leave SNAP benefits for 2013 at less than $1.40 per person per meal. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers has reached a tentative agreement with Alaska Airlines on a new labor contract for 2,500 clerical office and passenger service workers. The agreement includes pay raises and job security provisions. The members will be voting on whether or not to ratify the new contract, and the ratification results are expected in early April.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep communities safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
there are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test, a lot of them. And that's a concern for me because we're having a serious problem with that.
Go, go. I messed up my entire life go. Because I got high. Go. I lost my kids and wife because I got high.
Say what?
Now I'm sleeping on the sidewalk and I know why.
Why, man?
Yeah, hey, because I got high. Because I got high. Because I got high.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. You know, our governor, that's our governor, you know, saying, you know, if you remember during the campaign in 2010, it was because the unemployed people were lazy. Then they were didn't have the skills, uneducated, lazy, uneducated first. Then, well, they're just a bunch of drug addicts, right? Obviously, it must be something because it's not the crummy economy, is it? And when I look at what's going on, especially right now with our governor and what's going on in Washington, you gotta point finger where finger belongs, and that's at our friends in the Republican Party. And if you remember back on December 28th, the federal unemployment extension for our family members, our friends, our neighbors, you know, the folks struggling to find work in an economy where you've got three people looking for every open job, well, that unemployment extension, an abrupt ending, ended. The ability for folks to get this one lifeline. And what they got was a lump in a coal for Christmas. And worse yet, what I would say, a kick in the gut. And it's been 37 days since the Republican-led attack on our struggling workers. Some 1.7 million families, friends, neighbors cut off without a lifeline. And if this gridlock and this filibuster continues, we could see well over 3 million by close to the end of 2014. Here in Pennsylvania, that number right now, thanks to our Republican friends since December 20th, 73,330 folks cut off. By the end of this year, you could see that number jump to 262,000 families cut off without a lifeline. And the amount of money being taken out of our economy, that's another part of this that nobody seems to be talking about. Right now, you're talking over $25 million going to be gutted from our economy, which in my estimation is going to make our unemployment problems that much worse. But here to talk to us a little bit about what's going on in her life, what this unemployment extension means to her and her family, I've asked Helene Larusevich to come and talk to us. Helene, thanks for taking time for me.
Sure, no problem.
You know, we see this frame, Helene, that the unemployed are lazy or they're uneducated, or as our governor said there, they can't pass a drug test. When you hear those things, does it make you angry?
Yes, it does, as a matter of fact, because I don't happen to fall into any of those categories at all. I mean, I can certainly pass a drug test tomorrow, and I am educated. I have a college education. I have a degree in physics. And for the last almost 9 years, I functioned as an environmental health and safety officer for a major construction company in the suburbs here of Philadelphia. So I certainly don't fit into any of those categories.
So health and safety, I got to imagine that had to happen while our governor was, was in office, because, you know, this is just a trend that I see. A lot of our health and safety things seem to be going away. This push towards deregulation, this push towards, well, you know, let what be. I would have to imagine that had something to do with it, no?
Well, actually, my company actually called me in on the 30th of April, and I was reporting for my normal weekly meeting to my manager, and he told me that my position was being outsourced, and that it was being outsourced to a local company, and they would only use that person when they actually needed him. So they would essentially not have anyone completely on staff and have to pay them benefits and, you know, a salary and so on and so forth. They would use an outside agency for a as-need basis. So at that point in time, that's when I began, you know, my unemployment. And I did have some severance from the company. That ran out at the end of June, and I began unemployment compensation in July. And that ran out on the state level exactly when they discontinued the the benefits in December for the long term.
And at the absolute worst possible time. I mean, the holiday season, the walk into the new year, for anyone who's ever had to look for work during that time period, they know it is absolutely the worst time to be looking for jobs, and especially in this economy that has not produced the number of jobs that we need, and especially here in Pennsylvania, where we are at the bottom of job creation, in my view, thanks to the policies of this governor.
Well, it was the absolute worst time. I think in the fourth quarter of the year, you know, you're nearing the end of everyone's budgets, and you're ending people's fiscal years. They're not spending money, and they're not going to onboard a new hire unless they absolutely have to at that point in time. So you're essentially, I wasted the last quarter of the year. That's not to say that I wasn't applying for jobs. I mean, I have 138 applications for jobs. I have them all cataloged, too, and I have 24 interviews, some of them telephone, some of them in person. The in-person interviews were over 3 hours in length, some of them. So, you know, it's not to say that I'm not trying and that I'm not out there looking for it. I had an interview this morning. That's a telephone interview that hopefully will pan out. But it's no guarantee. And people will say, well, you know, just take anything. Well, I have news for you. You can't just take anything.
Yeah.
I called a national employment agency, and I said, I will take anything. I'm desperate. I have no money coming in. And they said, well, it doesn't work like that.
Well, they won't take you. I mean, the reality
is... Well, they're not going to take me because it costs money to onboard somebody onto an organization. And if they look at my resume and it's not matching up for the job description, they know I'm going to bolt when I find a job in my field.
Exactly. And that's the thing that nobody seems to really be talking about is we have a bunch of highly educated folks who can't find jobs in the fields that they were doing, and employers lower down the line won't hire them because just what you said. They know that as soon as something opens up, they're going to move on. And that, again, doubly, I think, harms the unemployed worker, especially somebody who's highly educated and has the experience that you sound like you have.
Exactly. And, you know, to your point, you know, you said, I believe you said that's $25 million not going back into the economy. I don't know who takes their unemployment money and says, finally, my trip to the Caribbean. I mean... Every person that I know that is collecting unemployment takes that money and puts it directly back into the economy by buying groceries and paying utilities and you know, paying rent if they're in an apartment. They're not defaulting on their home loans. I mean, I just can't understand why they would not go forward with it.
Yeah, I mean, Helene, you know, the reality is there's a And I don't know your political persuasion. I don't think it matters to me. But there is a move in this country with a wing of the Republican Party. I'm not going to clump them all into it. But a wing that I think believes in punishment, and that if you're in a tough way, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, even if you don't have bootstraps.
Well, I mean to tell you, I have lived always by the philosophy to pull myself up by my bootstraps. I'm ex-military. I have an education. I didn't get put through college by my parents. I worked my way through college. And I'm here to tell you that, you know, I'm like the queen of pulling herself up by her bootstraps. And I have been pulling out every stop I know to make my unemployment cease. And I have yet to be successful. So,
and the other thing, Helena, I hear that often. And I talk to numerous folks who have been long-term unemployed. And like you, they're struggling to make it to the next day, to make it to the next interview. And at a certain point, and I don't know if you're at that point yet, but, you know, some people have told me at a certain point, the phone interviews stop, the in-person interviews stop because, you know, I guess employers start thinking, well, if nobody else wanted you after 6 months or 8 months, well, we don't either. So I'm curious, you know, you said you had the interview today, but are you starting to see maybe a slowing down of stuff? I'm curious.
Well, the fourth quarter was a complete disaster.
Yeah, the holidays.
It was completely dry. And now I'm seeing a little bit of a pickup, but what you're saying is absolutely true. After a certain point that, you know, you remain unemployed, you almost become poison fruit. They wonder what's wrong with you. I've actually been asked, oh, so you're still unemployed, you know, when it came to are you working now or, you know, or what? And it's like, yes, I am still unemployed. You know, so it's harder, and I think it's going to get harder still if I remain unemployed.
I haven't been unemployed a couple of times in my life in the past. And it really does something to you psychologically as well, because all of that constant rejection. I mean, you said well over 100 applications you've sent out and job contacts. At some point, you know, there's part of me that goes, you know, you start to question whether you're ever going to find a job.
Yes, precisely. And, you know, when I left my position at my former company, I was on the top of my game. I was a go-to person, you know, and now I'm sitting at home, essentially, you know, existing. And,
I mean, there's also a cautionary tale right there, because I talk to so many people who don't think that it can happen to them. You know, I'm the go-to person. I'm the one who always bails them out. I know where everything is. People think that, you know, if they work hard and they play by the rules and, you know, they're loyal and dedicated, that it can't happen to them. And what I'm hearing from you is, and I've heard from so many people, is that it doesn't matter. If there's a buck to be made to outsource your job to an independent contractor, goodbye. It was nice knowing you.
Let me tell you, and I'm not trying to use this as like a sympathy card. Back in 2009, I was handed a huge project. I was going to move my company. All right, I was going to project manage the move of my company from one building to another. And approximately a month later, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I thought, that's just great, you know? Like, I just get handed this plum assignment, and I get cancer, you know? So when we found out that, you know, what was what with the cancer, and I wasn't going to need chemo, but I was going to need radiation. Well, the radiation was going to coincide right at the time when all of the move was in its fervor.
Don't tell me you put off the radiation.
No, I didn't put off the radiation, but I would literally leave my place of employment, get my radiation, and either go home or come back to work, and sometimes work into the evening. And my husband and I actually had some bitter arguments over that, and I remember vividly telling him, no, you don't understand. This is going to make my bones, all right? This is going to prove to them that I'm serious about my work and I can be counted on, even in a crisis, you know? And in the end, it doesn't matter. If they have an agenda or if you can be had for something cheaper or whatever the reason, I mean, I had an excellent performance review where my manager was like, oh, you're just so smart and you're the go-to person, like literally 2 months before I was terminated. So there are no guarantees. There are no guarantees.
And, you know, I look at this, and I've had these conversations with far too many people, unfortunately, over the last couple of years. It just is what it is. Let me ask you about the breast cancer then, because now – I hope that your husband has health insurance, because when I was unemployed, I couldn't afford the Cobra. I don't know many people who
can afford Cobra.
I don't know many people who can. So you've got this pre-existing condition, which fortunately is no longer a reason to deny you health care. But what are you doing for health care in the event that something comes back?
Well, fortunately, my husband has a job, and he has health care through his employer. So I was able to get on to his health care benefits. But, you know, if this were, you know, in a different time, maybe I would have this pre-existing condition. So right now I'm 100% cancer-free, and I'm clean bill of health up to this point, knock on wood. So I have benefits through my husband. I was lucky. I had a backup plan. There are some people who, if I didn't have my husband and I didn't have that backup plan, if I would have had – you know, had been terminated, I would not have been able to afford Cobra. It's extremely expensive.
Oh, it's impossibly expensive. I mean, it's one thing to say you have this option, but good luck affording it.
Especially when your income is completely reduced from what it was.
Yeah, you're talking about 45% of your income up to a certain capped level. And if you go back just a couple of years when, you know, my former state representative led the charge to revamp, if you will, the unemployment compensation system in this state, where they froze the maximum benefit for the next decade and then turned around and gave a huge tax break to corporations, just kind of, you know, to me, showed the viewpoint of workers and employers in this country and in this Commonwealth by our leaders. You know, one of the things I did want to ask you about, because, you know, we look at unemployment benefits, and I think the average in the state's about $350 a week, which I don't think is living high off the hog. But there's this image out there, Helene, that there are people who are just, you know, they're just having a high old time. You know, going to play squash in the morning, hiding their money in the Cayman Islands, you know, using the Swiss bank accounts, all of that stuff. So I'm curious, you know, in looking at your life change since you lost your job, or it was taken from you, I shouldn't say lost, you know where it is, how has your life changed?
Well, right now, as it stands in this exact moment in time, my savings is almost gone. I moved the last amount of money from my savings account into my checking account so that I could pay the bills at the beginning of, at the end of this week for the beginning of this month. And if nothing happens, so I either have to get a job, all right, or something's got to break with the unemployment. Otherwise, we're out of money by best case scenario, the middle of February or the middle of March, rather.
So
that's
what,
it.
What can we do to help? I understand there's a push right now to get a 3-month extension, which I'm going, hold on, wait a minute. December 28th was almost a month and a half ago. By the time this passes, we're going to be arguing about another extension of people being cut off, but at least there'll be some retroactive money. What should folks be doing?
Well, right now, the best thing that they can do is a toll-free call. Just call your senators at 877-363-6141. That's 877-363-6141. In Pennsylvania, you want to talk to Senator Pat Toomey. In Ohio, Senator Rob Portman. In Indiana, Senator Dan Coats. In Illinois, Senator Mark Kirk. And in Wisconsin, Senator Ron Johnson. At one point or another, all of these individuals have said they'd support an extension if it was paid for. And the version being voted on Thursday is fully paid for, and it's the 3-month extension retroactive to the 28th. So call. You have to call.
Yeah. Have you called Senator Toomey?
I've emailed him. I've called and left a message, and I've also emailed him. And his response to me was pretty much, you know, it's canned response. My husband has emailed everyone and their brother in Washington.
Yeah. No,
and he gets canned responses back, and he gets responses, and I'm talking, you know, from the Republican Party. He gets responses that are almost trite, and it's sad. You know, like they're giving him a history lesson. Well, in the past we did this, and in the past we did that. Listen to the past. This is the present.
This is right now, and we've got people who are struggling.
This is the here, and this is the now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm representative of the people who are unemployed. They're not people going off to play squash or going to hide their money in the Cayman Islands or all the other scenarios you suggested. And I'm certainly not a person who couldn't pass a drug test or any of the other scenarios that have been suggested. You know, somebody offer me a job, and I will go to work tomorrow.
Helena, I appreciate you taking time for us. I wish you nothing but the best of luck. Keep up the faith. Keep up the fight. I wish nothing but the best for you.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Helene, Laura Savage, I appreciate the time. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The steel strike of 1919 was called the Hunky Strike because most of the workers were either first or second generation immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe. Up until the end of World War I, workers had benefited from shorter hours, better pay, and the promise of union recognition. Once the war came to an end, the mill owners pursued anti-union open shop policies and other cost-cutting measures. During the strike, there was near total suppression of all civil liberties. Major work issues included the 12-hour day, the 7-day work week, scores of workers being injured and maimed, union recognition, and poverty wages. Mary Harris, better known as Mother Jones, fought tirelessly throughout her life for social justice and human rights as a labor leader and a worker advocate. On August 20th, while visiting striking miners in Homestead, Pennsylvania, home of U.S. Steel's famous Homestead Steelworks, she defied injunctions against public gatherings and addressed 5,000 striking workers and their families. This speech led to her being arrested and jailed for giving an unauthorized speech. When brought before the judge, she was asked who had signed a permit to speak at a public gathering. She answered, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As the strike went on, Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, gave many speeches to rally the workers. One speech in Chicago was described by a spy for the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division as the foulest and most profane that can be imagined, teeming with ultra-radical suggestions. Welcoming the spies, she would invite them to the front of the crowd so they could report her words accurately. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So the governor in his speech today, not much in the way of jobs plans, not much in the way of how we're going to fix the economy. But, hey, he made the little quip. It's the last call on the wine and spirit shops being owned by we the people. And again, this fetish that the Republicans have with assets held by us seems, I got to be honest, a little over the top. Look, I mean, on this program for years, we've been asking the question, what is it that we've privatized that's actually worked better for us? What is it that we've privatized that's been cheaper, more efficient, and better for society? Name something. And I've asked expert after expert. I've asked people who they spend their lives doing this kind of work, and none of them can come up with anything. Yet the frame out there, the frame that keeps being thrown up, privatization is best. The private sector can always do it better. I look at the parking, and I'm dealing with a situation right now myself. And look, I don't wish this on anybody. The Harrisburg Parking Authority, now that it has been privatized, is a nightmare to deal with at this point. I have called numerous times. I have called for hours trying to get through. Once you get through, you either get a voicemail or you get somebody who says, oh, our computers are down. I'll call you back. Take a deep breath and hold. I sent emails. I've done all of these things, and I'm waiting for the citation to come in the mail because this is the gig, man. It's all about either you do what they tell you you have to do or they're going to make your lives miserable. It's not about customer service, not providing a good service, but none of that. It's about them profiting at your expense. That's what privatization has brought us. And I often ask the question, at what point do we not wake up and say, duh, look what's happened. And now this 3 years now, 3 years, they've been saying we're going to privatize the state wine and spirit shops. And nobody that I can find wants it. What's interesting, what people actually want, the Republicans aren't pursuing. And why is that? Well, because the people who fund their campaigns, well, they're the beer distributors. Think about this just from a very logical point of view. Lay this out. Think about this. The state wine and spirit shops, unionized workforce, good wage jobs, family-sustaining wages. They've got health care, stability, you know, all kinds of, and you know, good stuff. Provide good service, provide security. You don't see liquor stores being knocked off like you do in other states. You don't see underage kids walking around with a bottle of Jack or, you know, bottle of peach schnapps like when I was a kid. You don't see that stuff here. And why is that? Well, because you've got a workforce that they value their job. There's no incentive for them to break the law. There's no incentive for them to sell to kids. It's not. There's nothing there. You put it into the hands of the profiteers, there's a huge incentive. Now think about it. Just think about it from this frame. How many people actually want Jack on Jack or you know Jim Beam or you know Johnny Walker or any of the guys in the whiskey and all that? How many want that on the impulse aisle next to the Tic Tacs? You'd be hard pressed to find anybody. I'm sure there are a few people who you know I drink my fifth a day. A vast majority of people they don't want that. What people really want, they want to be able to buy a six-pack of beer on the way home. They want to go to the grocery store. They want to pick up a six-pack at the grocery store, maybe a wine cooler or something. That's what people want. That's not what's being offered. That's not what's being discussed. Understand the control, the argument that the Republicans are making.
They're saying the state controls. It's prohibition. The state has control over this.
The state also has control over how beer is being distributed as well, but they've done it through a private market. So all of these beer distributors who have control and all of these bars who have control of the six-pack, they all get their money, and they're all very well-to-do. Trust me, it is a regulated industry. It is something that doesn't have competition. It is what it is. You've got one place to go buy your beer, and it's that guy there who's got the license. Now, you don't see the Republicans going after that. Why is that? And I'll give you the reason. It's pure and simple. It has everything to do with gutting a political enemy. And those are the workers. Those are unionized workers. These Republicans have this hatred of unionized workers. Now, you go back to Pat Buchanan and Reagan and Eisenhower and Republicans of the past where, you know, there were union Republicans. The union wasn't the issue. But now that, as Pat Buchanan points out, now that you have a Republican Party that's in the back pocket of corporate America, they have to hate workers. They have to hate workers. It's that simple. So what this is about is gutting a workforce. It's not about offering choice to consumers. It has nothing to do with that whatsoever. And we all know that. But I found it interesting that the governor had to throw that out again. It's last call on the wine and spirits shop, but didn't bother to mention beer, which, oddly enough, is what people really wanted. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
I'm excited. Almost to the point of being giddy. It's a relief and just anxious to get it done.
Chattanooga, Tennessee Volkswagen worker Jonathan Walden, reacting to the news that workers in the plant will vote on whether or not to join the United Auto Workers Union. The vote is scheduled for February 12th through the 14th. VW is neutral in the organizing effort. That's important to Walden, who believes the union will win the NLRB supervised election. He says bringing the UAW into VW's Tennessee plant will be good for workers, the company, and the community, and the workers at the plant can't wait to get it done.
Oh, I'm absolutely confident. I have no doubt. The biggest reason that I want the UAW to come in is so that we, as employees of Volkswagen Chattanooga, can fully participate in the Volkswagen system. It's a system of co-determination where management and labor work together to address issues,
come up with new ideas, to innovate, just to help move the company forward.
UAW President Bob King says VW is known globally for its system of cooperation with unions and works councils, and the UAW wants to partner with VW and a works council to set a new standard in the U.S. for innovative labor management relations that benefits all involved. Works councils are used in Germany, but if the workers win and the UAW is authorized to represent them in Chattanooga, this would be the first works council in the U.S. King vowed when elected president of the UAW in 2010 to organize at least one of the foreign-owned auto plants in the South. Anti-union groups are worried that if workers at VW go UAW, other auto plants in the South will follow. Unlike many union organizing drives, this employer is not waging an anti-union campaign. And VW called on all third parties to honor the principle of neutrality. The $8.7 billion cut in food stamps that just passed the U.S. House targets mostly blue states controlled by Democrats. Nearly all of the cuts will come from 16 states that voted for Obama. 28 of the 32 senators are Democrats, so the cuts are targeted overwhelmingly at poor people living in these blue states. Food stamps, known as the SNAP program, were boosted in the wake of the Great Recession of 2008-09. The boost is going away along with more cuts. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, that will leave SNAP benefits for 2013 at less than $1.40 per person per meal. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers has reached a tentative agreement with Alaska Airlines on a new labor contract for 2,500 clerical office and passenger service workers. The agreement includes pay raises and job security provisions. The members will be voting on whether or not to ratify the new contract, and the ratification results are expected in early April.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Let's go. Let's find out what's going on abroad. Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service in the Ukraine. Luke, how's it going out there, buddy?
It's good. It's
cold.
About 3:30 in the morning and a few degrees below zero, but I'm doing great.
You sent me some pictures on Flickr, and wow. I mean, there are so many expletives. I don't have the dump button close enough to go through them. Holy, holy. What are you doing there, man? What are you doing there? Get out of there.
Oh, gosh. You're hitting a funny button for me. I've had my guard up the past few days, so it's nice to have an objective assessment.
Dude, you are standing
on the absurdity of this situation.
You are standing on a car smiling that looks like it was bombed. There's no smiling here. There are pictures of...
Dude. You're looking at a photo of my colleague Zach and I at the sort of barricades in Kiev, and we, you know, another journalist there offered to take a photo of us, and I thought I'd crack a smile. I didn't think that was entirely inappropriate. Zach went with the very, you know, solemn... face. I think that's what you're seeing.
I'm surprised they didn't shoot just for smiling.
Well, we were facing away from the area where the police were, so that may have had something to do with it. Just to back up a little bit, I think we talked about this a little last week when I was still debating going on this trip, but the things started to get kind of crazy here in Ukraine in November.
Right.
When the president decided to back up of a plan to sign an economic integration treaty with the EU. It's not the same as becoming an EU member, but it was sort of a preliminary step that he had basically promised to the people. But the minute he decided not only to sort of shelve that signing plan, but to take $15 billion in loans from Vladimir Putin. And as you could expect, that sort of cash from Moscow doesn't come without a whole bunch of strings.
Someone's soul.
The soul of the country, I think many people would say. They don't want to be subordinate to anyone at this point. And, granted, their economy is almost entirely reliant on natural gas that comes in on a pipeline from Russia. But at the same time, the people don't, you know, by and large, see Moscow as the leading cultural or political or economic influence on their country. It's a split country. Right. In the east, a slightly smaller portion of the country. They do speak Russian. They are culturally Russian, and they do look to Moscow for quite a lot. A little bit larger and more populated and more developed, the western part of the country, that's really not the case. People don't speak as much Russian, and they look at countries like Poland or Romania, very close by, and they see European Union countries doing very well. And sort of when you – there have been some polls released recently that say about 50% of the country would like to go towards the EU and are supportive of protests. So people came out in the street in November, gathered very peacefully like they did in 2004, and they were met with a considerable amount of force. And that really drove up the numbers of people, and you had sort of demonstrations swelling from about 100,000 to, you know, nearing a million people out in the center of the city. And this continued in the freezing temperatures over Christmas, when sort of most international media, you know, go on holiday like the average citizen, and we all sort of, you know, lose out on coverage. And then things fizzled up again in January. And there was an attempt by the president, and actually a successful move by the president, to pass some anti-demonstration laws. These are very strict. It basically made illegal all of the things that had been obviously frowned upon by the government as people took up camp in the main square of the city, but made them illegal. It gave a legal authorization for the police and security forces to use force to you know, clear the demonstrations, if you will. And I think it was 2 weeks ago, this is the 22nd now of January, four men, young men, I think three of them in their 20s or early 30s, were shot and killed in and around this protest site in downtown Kiev. And after that, it really changed this whole dynamic. And people will say, oh, the numbers of people gathering in Kiev has gone down. That is true. But what's happened is that people have fanned out all around the country. They've gone to their local, you know, government administrative capitals, and they've occupied those. Now, they've sort of repeated what has happened here in Kiev elsewhere, deciding that they don't need to you know, go to the capital to air out their grievances. They'll be more direct about it and go to local areas. So the numbers are down here a little bit. Things are becoming entrenched, and we'll talk in a minute about the actual encampment, which you're probably looking at some photos of. But people have sort of dug in at the moment, and the parliament, as we speak, is about to go into session again tomorrow to try to hash out some sort of compromise here. But the opposition is very splintered. And it seems hard to see how this is going to go forward. Everyone has dug in their heels politically and physically on the square. Violence has ebbed a little bit at the moment. But, again, I don't see a clear way out, and that makes a lot of people anxious. They don't know who's going to be the first to get so frustrated with this impasse that they, you know, resort to violence or something of that sort. So sort of a lot of guessing at this point.
Yeah, the reports that I saw on it, you know, said that they weren't able to – the legislature, the lawmakers weren't able to curb any of the presidential powers at this point. And I guess that's what a lot of this is hedging on.
Yes. The office of the presidency has gained in influence quite a lot through constitutional reforms over the past decade. And sort of the real target for most of these groups would be a restoration of the 2004 Constitution. But we heard today in Parliament from Vitaly Klitschko, the world heavyweight champion boxer, who is an MP here and, you know, a pretty prominent opposition figure, a much more moderate target, saying, oh, let's just repeal back to 2010. So what you're seeing is a lot of these groups want some of the same things. They'd like to see the president go. They'd like new elections at the presidential level and at the parliament level. But when it comes down to, you know, coming in front of the parliament, proposing sort of what happens next, you have this wide array of people going for a home run, and then, you know, figures like Klitschko who want to, I think, be president and have a broad appeal, really scaling back their demands in the hope of getting something passed. And the result is that there probably just aren't the votes, even among this very vocal opposition, to do much of anything at this point. And the winner in that situation is the president.
Yeah. Yeah, I look at it, and it's a really screwed up situation. I'm looking at the pictures you sent, and wow, I mean, really, wow. Who is this Yulia woman? I've seen the picture of her you've taken a couple of times, a blonde woman that says Free Yulia.
She is an opposition figure who you know was the prime minister in I think it was 2006 around then. In 2004 there was the Orange Revolution, which was quite famous visually because the sort of pro-Western candidate was poisoned. His face sort of broke out in these awful sores right after the votes were counted, and he was shown to have not won. People started saying there was fraud, the election was rigged, and he started displaying signs of being poisoned, and people sort of thought they'd figured out that there was some sort of outside, perhaps Russian influence on the election. So the opposition actually took over. They were elected to the presidency, and they governed very poorly. Yulia Tymoshenko was in power. That blonde woman who you'll see in the photos on talkradionews.com, she didn't do a very good job. She ended up being imprisoned for corruption and sort of the same spoils of power variants that there are being lobbed at the current president. But, look, you know, one person's a bad president is another person's sort of revolutionary hero. And for a lot of the people at this current protest, they see her as a figure that was improperly imprisoned. And as ineffective as she may have been governing, they'd like to have her out of jail and sort of back the political scene.
You know, I was reading a story earlier that said that, you know, there had been a rollback of some of the president's anti-protest legislation, that maybe they pulled back on some of that. Is that factual?
Yes, they did. But it's sort of a two steps forward and one step back. A lot of the elements of that law are still in effect. But that was part of a plan by the president to offer some concessions, to be the one appearing to be conciliatory. The other thing he offered was an amnesty bill that would sort of create a expedited pathway to getting, I think it's over 1,000 at this point, people who have been detained and are still in custody because of their activities in these ongoing protests and occupations of government buildings. But that was a conditional offer on the fact that all the currently occupied buildings would be vacated. That's not something that the opposition is willing to consider. So, you know, we're sort of left at this stage where the president has offered pretty much all it looks like he's going to offer. And he has now turned it over to the opposition to put forward their demands. And if this week ends with the parliamentarians from the opposition having 2 days now, I think it's also maybe an interesting move by the government to give them a whole other day to try to come up with something. If they fail tomorrow, the second day in a row of failing to propose anything concrete, now that the ball is in their court, I think the alienation really might set in here. And who knows what could happen? Maybe they will propose something in common. Maybe they will maybe say the 2010 Constitution is good enough. But again, if tomorrow comes and goes without anything being proposed and even less anything being agreed to, I think a lot of people aren't going to know where this thing goes. You have these thousands of people basically living in this type of encampment in the Capitol. It's like a non-governmental space. There's no police. Everything is volunteer. People are fed. People are clothed. They sleep there. There are militias that basically roam around freely and carrying guns and knives and batons and sort of ruling things and kicking out the people they want and keeping others, you know, there's a stasis that's set in. And I think that actually works against these protesters. If it seems like it's so normal just to continue having this little occupied space, it loses the radical momentum that right. I think it had in shaking up the political landscape. So I don't know what will happen after tomorrow, but it could certainly change. They haven't since we got here, but this uncertainty still dominates, and that is a risky thing.
Because that was the question I was going to ask you. What happens if they just ignore them and marginalize them? Is there any talk of what's next from the folks who are living out on the streets? You know, because at some point you can see them just going, well, you know, we're just going to leave them there.
Well, I can, you know, run through just two options that come to mind. One would be to get violent. I don't know how this would happen exactly. There's so many barricades, actually, that have been erected to keep the police out that I think it would actually make it kind of hard to attack them. The position where I filmed a good number of photos, this sort of apocalyptic scene near where the houses of parliament are, is actually so well protected against the police. I think the only thing they can do is lob things over the wall. You can't, charge or anything, God forbid, towards the police at this point. The other option, I guess, and I've heard this from many people, is to go and occupy more government buildings. These are not very viable means of getting anything done,
right.
Particularly because I think there was a big misstep. This occupation of certain government buildings has certainly been effective, particularly when in more rural parts of the country they stormed into governor's offices and forced them to resign on the spot. I mean, that sends a very powerful message of who's in charge of the provinces. But in the capital here, besides getting some useful buildings that were very helpful for the management of this encampment, they went and seized the Justice Ministry, which a lot of people say they should have known was a bad move because the Justice Minister is very ill-tempered. She was extremely upset with this action. I guess she had sort of been okay with everything else, but this crossed the line. And as they started storming into the building, she put out a message saying, if this continues past the sunset, I will impose martial law on the country. And they ended up sort of abandoning that occupied building. So that strategy seems to have sort of exhausted its ability to be successful, too. We're looking at Parliament, and I don't see Parliament coming together in any way. These parties all want to be president. They're not the type of similar interest parties that are going to form any sort of coalition if there's a new election. They all will be at each other's throats before too long. And even in this phase of sort of somewhat anarchy and real frustration with the president, they can't even get united now, and they certainly wouldn't after this.
Wow. So let me ask you a last question. As you're there, any uneasiness with you? I mean, have you had any problems to this point? I would assume outsiders, reporters from outsiders, can be looked at in two ways, as A, intruders, or B, someone who's going to help tell the story. Which have you encountered either?
I've been kind of paranoid this whole trip. Even now I'm in a courtyard outside of my hostel, and there are apartment buildings all around, and my voice is kind of loud for the radio, and things are echoing, and most people are asleep at 4 a.m. But I am wary, and after the Snowden revelations, you don't even need to have people hearing you on the spot to think that communications are being monitored. We've been trying to keep a low profile. We only, take certain types of transportation around. We will be leaving the Capitol shortly. I won't say where we're going next, but we are planning to go to another part of the country where we will get a very different impression of the scene that we're getting in the opposition camp here. So the intention is to tell both sides of this story, and I think at the end of the day, being as objective as we can. Certainly, when people die at the hands of the police, that is something that is upsetting to hear about, no matter what your political persuasion is. But we will be seeking out people who do support Russian integration, who are culturally Russian, and who support the president, because it is about 50% of the population still in this country, and we have 50% of the trip to go and want to give them a chance to have their thoughts, immortalized, if you will.
Yeah, I look forward to it. But above all, stay safe, Matt.
I will do. And I think Zach may be calling in later this week.
Hopefully
you'll get a follow-up report.
I look forward to it. Luke Vargas, appreciate the time. Stay safe, brother. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Will do. Take care. Good night.
You look at this and you go, wow, maybe when I was in my 20s, maybe, but no, I don't know. God bless him. And I wish him nothing but the best and safety and in health and a safe return home. We're going to take a quick break, right back. Stick around.
Of 4. for and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
I've noticed that local celebrations of Martin Luther King Day tend to be unique, for they've generally not been turned into yet another excuse for beer and barbecue parties. Rather than trivialize the meaning of this courageous man's life, most people treat the day as a moment of serious reflection. Many even memorialize it by vowing to confront the powers that be on some of the big issues that Reverend King asked America to redress, such as entrenched racial inequality and the exploitation of poverty wage workers. But now, I've learned that joining the gritty struggle for justice is not the proper way to honor King. No, no, 'tis a far better thing you do if you just traipse down to a local McDonald's outlet, order a Happy Meal, and join the joyous, integrated Golden Arches family in singing a few verses of Kumbaya. At least, that's what the world's largest hamburger chain urged us to do in a shameless PR campaign. It used this year's MLK Day to try whitewashing its own sorry record of worker mistreatment. One full-page ad pictured three McDonald's crew members, each one a person of color, beaming with delight above ad copy that extolled the corporation's commitment to, quote, a diverse and inclusive workforce. I think Dr. King would have upchucked and asked, what about a workforce that's paid a living wage with benefits so they don't have to work second or third jobs and go on food stamps to subsidize the labor costs of this miserly, super-rich fast food empire? The touchy-feely ad turned a total squish at the end, calling on all Americans to embrace their differences. We can't imagine a better way to honor King's Day than by doing just that. This is Jim Hightower saying, Dr. King, however, had a sharper imagination than that. He would have helped the workers unionize McDonald's to gain real justice for themselves.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Minimum wage!
You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you? It's like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
Oh, man, if that isn't the truth, if that isn't the absolute truth. And, you know, I love the folks who keep saying, oh, but, Rick, there's the meritocracy. Oh, if you work hard, you play by the rules. Yes, you'll earn more if you're educated and all that. Yeah, you know what's interesting? The facts are in on that. And, you know, as we talked about yesterday, we are a much more educated society than we were back in the 50s and 60s. A much more educated society than my grandparents' generation. Much higher rates of college attainment. More than double the attainment of high school graduation. Yet that pesky minimum wage, you can't survive on. It's that simple. And I just had an interesting conversation with a friend who said, you know, he was talking to an old timer who said, you know, he said, you know, when I got out of high school, you know, my father said, you know, you're not going to college. You're not going to do that. So what are you going to do? You have two choices. You know, one, you go get a job and you pay us here to stay here, or two, you go get a job and you go rent another place. And what he said, the old timer said he went and he got a job and he got his own apartment. And he was making like $2.30 an hour or something, which at the time was like 17, 18 bucks an hour now. And it was a menial job. It was just shoveling. He said he was shoveling some kind of iron ore, coal, some kind of thing, into a furnace. And he was making a decent living. And as he was there longer, as he was loyal to the company, he moved up and was able to, you know, to move into a lower management position, much like my former father-in-law. Those days are gone. And it's not because, well, we live in a global age, Rick. Don't you know? We're living in a global time. We've always lived in a global time. We've always had global trade. We just had policies. We just had trade rules that benefited us. And you had corporations who, they kind of got the bounds. You know, after the Great Depression, when you had hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, and the corporate class realized that their heads, quite frankly, could have been on platters, they kind of tap down that insatiable greed. But you've got now a wealth class that they don't care about anything. They can raise their own private U.S. Army. Because look at all the wars we've gotten into over the last several years just for that purpose.
Got to protect our interests after all, Rick, don't you know?
Got to protect our interests. I don't know about you, but I don't have many interests in the Middle East. I don't have many interests in a lot of places we've been. Corporate America does. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I appreciate all the input, all the thoughts, all the comments. Can't do this without you. Appreciate you being here. Look forward to being back again tomorrow. Hope you'll tune in right here, same time. As always, here at therickSmithShow.com. Thanks a lot. We'll see you back here. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tidal flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Yeah, Tracy'd show up with all that nobility done gone, fresh out. Yeah.